They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The last time there was an earthquake as deadly as today's in China was, Chairman Mao was still alive. Obviously, a lot changes in 32 years and nowhere more than in China. But a major earthquake doesn't really care. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, May the 12th. Good to have you with us. It's already early tomorrow morning in China. The latest official figures from Beijing are that just over 8,600 people are known dead so far. We've got our China correspondent Scott Tong on the line with us. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
Scott, the headlines all day here in the States have said big earthquake in southwest China's Sichuan province. It's about 900 to 1,000 miles from where you are. Tell us what's out there.
Sichuan is a little bit like the middle of North America. There's a lot of agriculture there, and farming is generally not a very profitable sector in China, which means that the province of Sichuan is pretty poor. The other thing is Sichuan is the source of a lot of low-cost labor. In other words, a lot of migrants leave this poor part of China and go to the coastal provinces and work in factories. Now, having said that, the central government is trying very hard to bring in foreign investment to bring more wealth to that part of China.
So what's out there now since the government's been trying to build it up?
Well, the government has provided a lot of tax incentives to bring multinational companies to that part of China. Intel is there with a chip facility, and its competitor AMD just set up a competing facility. Microsoft and IBM are there. And there's auto industry, Ford and Isuzu and Mazda. And actually, all of those companies reportedly shut down some of their facilities for a while because of the earthquake. It's all part of what Beijing is calling its Go West policy, to bring wealth to Western China and to kind of even out the economic development. Because in China, it's really been, you know, the rich East Coast, and then the rest of China has still stayed quite poor, and they're trying to fix that.
Scott, I wanted to ask you about international assistance. Obviously, that's the big topic after the cyclone that happened down in Burma last week. Mm-hmm. What are the prospects when offers of assistance start coming in for the Chinese?
Well, those offers of international assistance are already out there. Japan and Taiwan, the European Union, and Washington have all offered it. And the question is whether Beijing is going to be responsive. Folks in the international nonprofit community are a little bit worried because they remember a massive earthquake in China in 1976, and that killed at least 240,000 people. At the time, China denied all outside assistance, and that was blamed for a lot of the casualty toll. And right now in China, there's a little bit of an anti-foreigner sentiment, and outside organizations are wondering how China's going to respond. Now, having said that, China has changed a whole lot since 1976, and I hate to say we'll see, but we'll have to see.
Scott Tong in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
Okay, Kai. Thank you.
It's worth a mention of what didn't happen after today's earthquake. The Shanghai Composite Index closed down, but just a tad, even after the tremor and despite an announcement that inflation hit a 12-year high last month. 8.5% is the actual number. The U.S. Supreme Court deferred to Wall Street today. 4 of 9 justices recused themselves from a case because of financial conflicts of interest. At issue was whether victims of apartheid can sue American companies that had dealings with South Africa's former apartheid government. We might never know what the court thinks because apparently the justices own stock in some of those companies. The law says you need at least 6 justices to hear a case, so the lower court ruling is going to stand. Jeremy Hobson has more now on when judges can't decide.
What happened today, 4 justices having to recuse themselves, is not typical. On the other hand, 1 justice recusing, that's already happened a couple times this term.
So after spending all that money and all that time, we're no better off than we were if they hadn't taken the case at all.
That's attorney James Beck, who worked on a drug company liability case that made it to the Supreme Court earlier this term. 1 justice had to recuse, and the case ended in a 4-4 tie, affirming the lower court's decision. Stephen Giller is an expert on judicial ethics at NYU, says conflicts of interest are more common these days at the high court.
It's not just an ongoing problem, it's an escalating problem.
Giller says that's because justices are entering the court richer and with more financial holdings. And the court has been taking more business cases in recent years, so there's more of a chance there will be a conflict. Giller says there are a few obvious solutions.
One is to say, look, if you want to be a justice, your investments have to be in mutual funds.
Or blind trust, for that matter. 2, he says, is to relax the ethical standards for recusal, though he's not in favor of that option.
And a third possibility, which is present in many state courts, is to allow the court to bring up a lower court judge in the event of a tie or the lack of a quorum.
1 other option that's been used before, a justice can simply sell the assets that present the conflict. Of course, that wouldn't have worked for Justice Anthony Kennedy. He recused himself from the apartheid case not because of stock. His son works for one of the companies involved. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Here's a news flash for you. Subprimes are out. Sewers are in. Actually, roads and bridges are in, too. Morgan Stanley announced today it's collected $4 billion for a new infrastructure fund. Credit Suisse and General Electric did them one better. Its fund has raised more than $5 billion. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay explains where they're going to put all that money.
It's not just Morgan Stanley and Credit Suisse. Goldman Sachs and the Carlyle Group are getting into the infrastructure game as well. David Narevsky is an attorney at Mayer Brown who works on private infrastructure deals. He says bridges and sewer systems may not look so sexy, but investors like them because they're safe.
When you look at the current state of the market with all the concerns about credit quality, in many ways, I think infrastructure really represents a flight to quality because it is stable, it is long-term, it isn't going anywhere. These are fixed assets.
Narevsky says these new funds are taking over toll roads and energy plants through long-term leases. The governments get a pile of cash up front, and in exchange, the funds operate the infrastructure and collect the tolls or user fees themselves. Dennis Enright of the NW Financial Group analyzes privatization deals. He says infrastructure projects can generate returns of 12 to 15%. That's why investors earmarked $100 billion for the sector over the past year.
And most of that money will get targeted not to U.S. Infrastructure, but to infrastructure around the world where private development of infrastructure is more common.
But U.S. cities and states are warming up to private ownership. Pennsylvania is currently taking bids from private companies to lease its 500-mile turnpike. The Chicago Midway Airport is expected to go on the block next. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
How much does Wall Street want the credit crisis to be over and done with? Well, the merest hint of a deal today helped drive the major indices up 1% or more. Rumor has it Hewlett-Packard's going to spend $13 billion to buy EDS, that's Electronic Data Systems. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It's probably not helpful to speculate about why certain commodities cost what they do. But oil at $120-something dollars a barrel can't be all supply and demand, right? That's the working premise for a House investigation that'll start next week into the role that speculators are playing in the surging price of crude. Fact is, though, that demand is up, in part because of growth in developing economies. Commentator Fareed Zakaria says that growth speaks volumes about our current economic crisis.
Just when you thought that oil couldn't get more expensive, the price is now hovering around $125 a barrel. How did we get to this crazy place? It was just 10 years ago that oil was trading at $20 a barrel. In other words, prices have quintupled in a decade. Had we asked economists and forecasters what would happen in such a scenario, they would have all said two words: global recession. That hasn't happened. And it isn't likely to happen just yet. Oil prices are high not because producers are choking off supply, but because consumers in the United States, Europe, China, India are increasing demand. Expensive oil is one facet of the signature trend of our age, global growth. Last year, 124 countries around the world grew at over 4%. This year, despite the American slowdown, growth in most of those countries remains robust. While we debate the current financial panic and impending recession, our future is not likely to be shaped by crisis and collapse. The real problems we will face will be the consequence of what I call the rise of the rest of the world, that is. Look around. It's not just oil that is soaring. Almost every commodity is at a 200-year high. Wheat and rice prices have doubled and then kept on rising over the last 2 years. In some cases, demand is so high that we're actually running out of stuff. Helium, the gas used in balloons and MRI machines, is in short supply globally, and it is the second most abundant element in the universe. The problems of growth are, of course, high-quality problems. But on this scale, they are problems we have never really experienced before. We know how to handle a recession, but how do we handle the rise of the rest? That will be the real challenge of the next decade, long after this recession has turned to recovery.
Fareed Zakaria is the editor of Newsweek International. His new book is called The Post-American World. Send us your thoughts. Online is best. Our homepage is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Got some good news and some bad news for the staff over at Bear Stearns today. The good news is that J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon said today he figures what's left of Bear will eventually be worth $1 billion a year at some point in the future. Dimon led the Fed-sponsored bailout of Bear Stearns earlier this spring, you might remember. Now, though, on to the bad news. Dimon says he's only going to keep about 40% of the current Bear Stearns staff on his payroll. Ashley Milne-Tite reports today's decision is only going to make an already tough job market on Wall Street even more difficult.
Wall Street did much of its 2008 hiring on campuses last fall before the damage from the credit crunch fully emerged. Rick Copeland runs recruiting firm Capstone Partnership. He says, Bear aside, the major banks will stick to their commitments. Back in 2001, Merrill Lynch reneged on job offers. When the firm returned to elite campuses to recruit, many students wouldn't talk to them.
They found that they were not getting the top of the class, which is important to investment banking because they always want to get the best and the brightest. So they found that they were getting sort of the middle of the class, and it showed up in the following years. Performance was not as good, and it affected their business.
William Wright Swaddell is a career services director at Harvard. He says juniors heading to summer internships landed those positions just as the banking turmoil was escalating.
So I think students are already beginning to say, okay, next year, how is this going to play out? And if I'm still interested in Wall Street, what do I need to do?
Even seniors who have jobs aren't necessarily relaxed. Joshua Borenstein at NYU accepted an offer from a small investment bank last November. Even so,
because of the way the market is with what's happened to Bear Stearns and friends of mine who have lost, you know, their jobs with Bear or their internships, and because I'm working at a small company, there is some fear that my job might not be there in August.
He says he's keeping in regular touch with the bank just to make sure everything stays on track. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up, trying to buy organic in Israel.
Sometimes I find it very hard to track who's the actual producer of the product that I take from the shelf.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks gained today as a rising dollar cooled inflation fears. The Dow Industrials popped up 1%, 130 points to close at 12,876. The Nasdaq climbed 1.75%, 42 points to end at 2488. The S&P 500 rose 1%, 14 points, finished at 1402. Investors gave Research in Motion the thumbs up today after the company released its nifty new BlackBerry. The company stock picked up 6.9%. Bond insurer MBIA gained almost 4.5%, that even though it posted a $2.4 billion loss. The company said it's going to pump $900 million into its insurance business. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.79%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for April. President Bush departs for the Mideast. He has planned stops in Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. And the Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on a program that helps fund the purchase of bulletproof vests for police officers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Cheap airfares can be great, but now more than ever, you have just got to read the fine print, folks. Today, American Airlines joined the list of carriers that are taking an extra $25 from passengers wanting to check a second bag. Add that to the fuel surcharges that have been phased in over the past couple of months, and depending on where you're flying, the fees could add up to more than the airfare. It's tough to argue when airlines say they need the extra cash because their gas bills are soaring. But Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now from Washington the fees could send customers packing.
So you actually want to talk to a human next time you book a flight? That'll cost you anywhere from $5 to $25. Want curbside check-in? That's typically another $2 a bag. And the airlines are charging an arm and a leg for legroom.
You know, we'll give you 4 extra inches for $125. It's ridiculous.
James Wagner is 6'4". He towers over other passengers waiting for their luggage at Washington's Reagan National Airport. Wagner says it's hard to get the best deal now because some airlines include surcharges up front and others don't.
You think you've got a good price and you lock in, and then when they give you the total price, they add on all the surcharges and fees and taxes and everything else. So it's difficult to compare apples to apples on the net.
In fact, on some short flights, the surcharges cost more than the ticket itself. The airlines say they could improve service for everybody with an across-the-board fare hike, but they're afraid their customers would fly the coop for discount airlines. So the big boys turn to the surcharges, which are easier to impose. Some passengers, like 23-year-old Maisie Wilkinson, like the a la carte fee system.
I choose to fork up the $40 for extra legroom, and I get extra legroom.
But Jeff Stout, who flew into Washington from Salt Lake City, says he'd rather go back to a one-size-fits-all ticket price. He'd even pay more for the promise of better service.
I know the airlines have to make money, but I think they do themselves a disservice when people feel like they're always having their hand out for something.
Some passengers here say the surcharges are such a turnoff, they're starting to take the train to New York. Aviation attorney Josh Romanow says the airlines have to be careful.
And if the airlines price passengers out of the market and people stop flying, then the only thing they can do to get people back again is incentives, lowering fares, and a tale of the past, the days of the fare wars.
While you're waiting for war to break out, don't forget to pack extra cash. for your next flight. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
President Bush leaves tomorrow for a trip to the Middle East. He'll be in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Israel trying to drum up support for his peace plan. He'll also be on hand to celebrate Israel's 60th anniversary. The policy machine back home, though, won't be slacking off while the president's away. In fact, there is a brand new Jewish lobbying firm in Washington, J Street, it's called. Executive Director Jeremy Ben-Ami says he's not trying to bring down the well-established American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. He just thinks there's room for a different approach.
The situation in the Middle East is really at a critical point, and for all of us who do care about the state of Israel and are happy that it's reached 60 but hope that it has another 60 and many more years beyond it, we think the time is fast running out to reach a two-state solution to the conflict between the state of Israel and the Palestinians, and we feel it's essential to provide political support here in the United States for a next president and for Congress to put real American weight behind such an effort.
This is such a touchy issue in American politics, the issue of the Israel lobby and American policy toward Israel. Do you worry at all that it might detract from the mutual cause that you and other members of the Israel lobby have?
Well, I think that we all do share something in common. And, you know, we really do believe there should be a home for the Jewish people. We believe it should be a democracy. It should respect the rights of all the people who live there, both Jews as well as Israeli Arabs. The question is, what's the best way to build a secure and a prosperous future for the people who live there and its neighbors? And I believe that the way to security rests through ending the conflict peacefully. Others believe it lies through more military options and having to simply fight an endless conflict and expand settlements and expand an occupation. And we should have an open and an honest discussion about which of those visions for the future of Israel is better.
What exactly are you raising money for then?
We're going to be doing three things. The first is we're actually going to endorse political candidates for the House and the Senate. We're going to raise money for candidates that are willing to speak out on these issues and actually to support a pro-Israel, pro-peace agenda. Second is along the lines of Move On and the Dean campaign and the Obama campaign, we're going to grow an online list of supporters of tens of thousands of people who are going to advocate for these issues, who are going to make their voices heard. And the third is we're going to be lobbying very, very actively on Capitol Hill. And we're going to let members of Congress, senators, and their staff know that there are significant numbers of us out here who hold these beliefs.
Is there money in moderation?
I think that there is. And I think that in a way, it's not just moderation. It really is about being smart and being tough. I mean, we're not doves. For our purposes right now, one of the reasons that American politicians won't discuss and won't publicly say what they really think about the issue is they are afraid that they will lose political and financial support if they come out and say to be pro-Israel is actually to be pro-peace. And we want to show them that that won't have a cost, that there's actually a lot of us out here who are willing to support people who say that. And that gets measured, unfortunately, in financial and monetary terms.
Jeremy Ben-Ami is the executive director of Washington's newest lobbying group, one of them anyway. It's called J Street. It's an Israel lobby. Jeremy, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
There's no shortage of difficult issues Palestinians and Israelis have to agree on before there can be a peace like the one Jeremy Ben-Ami was just talking about. One of the most difficult is what to do about the growing number of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And it's not enough that Israelis and Palestinians can't agree. The settlements are a sore point between Israelis themselves, too. One that surfaces in the most mundane ways. Organic food is a great example. It's a $290 million a year industry. But to some Israeli consumers, where something is grown is sometimes more important than how. Daniel Estrin reports now from the West Bank.
This is a chicken's paradise.
Very early in the morning, you just open the door and they go out like a cloud. They're all out.
Sharona Ron and her husband Avri run an organic farm located in the hills of biblical Samaria. They call the farm Givot Olam, which means hills of eternity. It's a dramatic name, but for Sharona, it's no exaggeration.
It's like stepping on the steps of our ancestors, because it's really the place that All the Judaism grew from here, and you can feel it in the air if you know how to breathe here, and it feels exciting.
The Israeli government, however, is not as excited. Givot Olam is an unauthorized settlement outpost in the West Bank, but it's become one of the biggest producers of organic and free-range eggs in Israel. That disturbs Avi Levy, an organic consumer in Tel Aviv.
I don't think I want to buy products from this kind of person.
It puts an organic consumer like Levy in a predicament. He says importing food harms the environment and contributes to a global food crisis. But he doesn't want to support products made in West Bank Jewish settlements. He wants them dismantled to make way for the creation of a Palestinian state. Only about 3% of Israeli organic food is produced in West Bank Jewish settlements. Some consumers specifically search for products from West Bank settlements to support them. That would be an easy thing to do if every product made in a West Bank settlement would have the address of origin listed on the package. Problem is,
sometimes I find it very hard to track who's the actual producer of the product that I take from the shelf.
Levy browsed the shelves with me at the organic market in Tel Aviv. Many products did list the manufacturer's details. And then we got to the tahini aisle.
Organic sesame paste produced by producer code ADT.
One bottle after the other, the producer's identity was reduced to a string of letters or numbers.
Let me see, I have here carob almond spread. Producer code ANT.
Who is ANT? Well, the bottle did list the distributor's cell phone number. You want to call?
You can call.
So we called.
Hello. Shalom lecha. Ani po bechanut organic market b'Tel Aviv.
The conversation was not what I would call a model of customer service.
What did he say?
He said, what do you care about who's producing the product? You see, is it good? You like it? So eat it. What do you care? It's none of your business.
And then the manufacturer hung up the phone. By the way, Levy did a background check on the carob spread and the tahini. He suspects they're all made in West Bank settlements.
It was funny if it wasn't said. The whole issue behind the organic trend is getting to know where your food comes from and what happens with it, and that it's clean and safe.
If you would have called me after you got off the phone, I would have fixed the problem.
That's Ornit Raz. She heads the Organic Association, which sets the standards for organic food here. She believes that politics shouldn't be an ingredient in organic food.
We make sure the product is grown according to the organic principle of integrity, fairness, and reliability. Where he lives and all of this politics doesn't interest us.
It also doesn't seem to bother most Israeli consumers. Either that, or they're not reading the small print. The Israeli organic food industry grew 30% this year. From the West Bank, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, I was off on Friday. I had to go to Cincinnati for an interview. Procter & Gamble CEO A.G. Lafley, if you're curious, and we're going to have it on Conversations from the Corner Office in a week or two. But I digress. Coming back through the Cincinnati airport Friday, I noticed that they had those ski resort signs I mentioned last week. Green for newbie travelers, blue for intermediates, black diamonds for folks who know how to streamline themselves and zip right through security. The TSA agent at the checkpoint said the signs look nice, but they don't really do a thing. Everybody, she said, thinks they're experts, which, now that you think about it, it's probably kind of like skiing too, huh? Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 130 points. That's 1%. The NASDAQ gained 42 points, 1.75%. The S&P 500 bumped up 14 points. That is 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up tomorrow on the program, cutting down on corporate creativity.
You know, banks should not be allowed to hide their assets off balance sheet. That's simple. That's wrong. It should not be allowed. Investment banks should not be leveraged 30 to 1. Okay? 15 to 1 is enough.
We'll explain what those numbers mean. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
A
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.